In 2 Corinthians chapter 10, the Apostle Paul reminds us the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty in God to the pulling down of strongholds, casting down arguments, and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ. Apologetics Profile podcasts are designed to equip you with the resources and tools for engaging the ideas of other religions, worldviews, and cults that challenge your faith. Every Monday, a new conversation to help encourage and exhort you to engage with your non-Christian neighbors in conversation about the truth of the gospel.
In his scathing 2013 book, The Outsider Test for Faith, outspoken atheist John W. Loftus argues that religious faith of any kind is a delusion, and that most Christians do not examine their belief in light of other religions. Loftus's ideas have become quite popular among atheists, as you can imagine. Atheists who often will corner unsuspecting believers with questions about Christianity in relation to other religions. There are a multitude of videos on YouTube which capture professing believers struggling to articulate significant differences between their beliefs and those of other religions. Despite Loftus's anti-theistic rhetoric, he does make a few valid points, one of which is what he calls confirmation bias, which he describes as, quote, "the strong tendency we have for seeking to interpret information in a manner that confirms our expectations. We do it. All of us. Most of us don't know how to think differently. We seek to confirm rather than disconfirm what we believe," end quote. Loftus suggests that is why, quote, "most believers will not read a skeptical book. Instead, they'll rather read an apologetics book that confirms what they believe. Muslims will read books defending Islam, and Mormons will read books defending Mormonism. Very rarely will believers step outside and read the opposition," end quote. But of course, that is not true of all believers. There are many Christians, myself included, who step outside of Christianity to examine the worldviews and beliefs of other people. As it turns out, in a 2019 interview with Watchman Fellowship President James Walker, Loftus admitted he would not read a book written by atheist New Testament scholar Dr. Bart Ehrman, a book that countered John's belief that Jesus did not exist. Despite the fact that Loftus believed his outsider test for faith would naturally lead Christians to become atheists, it does make a valid point about the need for Christians to examine their faith in light of other religious claims. This does not mean we should or could become experts in comparative religious studies, but that we should know what we believe and why, and be equipped to give a defense of our faith with gentleness and respect to those who ask about the hope that is in us. In our time of increasing religious plurality and diversity, we can no longer afford to remain blissfully ignorant about our neighbors who may be Hindu, Muslim, or Buddhist. They might be from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or they may be Jehovah's Witnesses, or they may profess no religion at all. How might you respond to any of them? And how might you respond to an atheist or skeptic who tries to corner you about the differences between your faith in Christ and, say, a Muslim's faith in Allah, or a Hindu's faith in Vishnu or Krishna? If you haven't yet listened to our two previous episodes with Dr. Gary Habermas about the uniqueness of Jesus among other religions, we highly encourage you to check those out. We have some great resources and materials to help you get started in exploring other non-Christian religions, or if you're just having a conversation with someone of a non-Christian religion and you would like to go deeper. On the next two episodes of Apologetics Profile, we will provide even more insights and resources about other religions from Lindsay Mendenwald of Mama Bear Apologetics. Lindsay is the Director of Ministry Operations at Mama Bear Apologetics and resident worldview and world religion specialist. Lindsay holds a master's degree in apologetics and ethics from Denver Seminary, as well as a master's in public administration and a law degree. She recently contributed a chapter about Jehovah's Witnesses in the Harvest House Popular Handbook of World Religions, published in March of 2021. Lindsay also has written a four-page profile for Watchman Fellowship on religious pluralism, which you can access for free in the notes of this episode. As we begin our conversation, I ask Lindsay to give a general definition of religion and religious pluralism. Here is Lindsay Mendenwald.
Religion is basically a particular faith or worldview. A lot of times you'll hear worldview and religion used interchangeably. That's not exactly a perfect comparison because there are worldviews that aren't necessarily religions. A religion is a way that a person views the world and views things that are eternal, I guess is a good way to put it. Pluralism, then, there are a couple of definitions that can be used to discuss pluralism. What you've mentioned, prescriptive religious pluralism, is essentially saying that all worldviews or religions are equally true or valid. Descriptive religious pluralism is just acknowledging that religiously diverse people exist. So yes, Buddhists are real humans. there are atheists in the world. But when we are applying prescriptive religious pluralism, we're saying, well, what the Buddhist believes is just as true as what the atheist believes, which is just as true as what Christians believe. And obviously, that can't actually be true. And truth becomes very, very muddy when we start to think of worldview that way.
Mm. So it's good to distinguish between the acknowledgement that we live among and in a culture where there are a multiplicity of different beliefs about God. I think it was Martin Luther that said, everybody's a theologian.
Right.
So when you talk about God, whether it's God's existence or non-existence, or something like a Hindu or a Buddhist might say God consciousness, everybody is doing theology. It's just the question, as you say, is it okay to combine all these things? And it's not, because as you know, most world religions are exclusivistic.
Yes.
That this is the only way. I mean, when you talk to a Buddhist, you know, their public relations is, yeah, sure. But when they get behind closed doors, of course, the only way to get nirvana is to practice what they do. Mm-hmm. And so there's this exclusivity claim in Christianity that Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. How does this work in our pluralistic society? So we acknowledge there's a multiplicity of different religions, but the issue for us as Christians is to recognize that a lot of us, even people that claim to be following a particular religion, are imbibing other ideologies and worldviews. Like, we here in the West have this love of technology, and we aren't aware of how secularism might be influencing how we think about God. And so do you think, Lindsay, in this, in prescriptive pluralism, that people are unconsciously absorbing other worldviews and ideas into their faith? Or do you think, I mean, I think there would be two things. One, somebody would be deliberately, syncretistically combining Buddhism with Christianity, maybe. Mm-hmm. But then maybe there are a lot of Christians who are unconsciously absorbing secular ideologies into their beliefs without recognizing it. Did you find that to be true in your research, or what have you uncovered in that regard?
Yeah, so I actually think that most people will absorb a multiplicity of worldviews, probably unconsciously, but I do mention one example, and there are others, of a person who claims to be, for example, a Buddhist Christian. He's actually a professor of world religion at a seminary, and argues that you can be both, and that's okay. But if you look at if we're going to look at Buddhism and Christianity as worldviews, they don't really fit together in just their basic content. And it's difficult to say, oh, yes, you can absolutely be a Christian Buddhist. This isn't to say that, right, like there aren't similarities in worldview. And I think that's where people kind of get confused sometimes.
Right.
But I believe in the golden rule as a Christian, right? Like Matthew 7:12. But that golden rule isn't just exclusive to Christians. There are other worldviews that have something like the golden rule. Buddha, for example, had a variation of it. Muslims have it in their hadiths. Jewish people find it in the Talmud, right? So the golden rule is something that is similar amongst worldviews. But that doesn't make all of everything that is within those worldviews true.
Gotcha. So it's not just because we all share this idea of the golden rule. I think of C.S. Lewis's Abolition of Man,
yes,
where he compiles past and present, I think mostly past, this idea of the Tao, mm-hmm, or the Tao, where he compiles similar moral ethics that can be found throughout people's places and times. And certainly there is a great deal of, his point is there's a great deal of overlap and agreement, mm-hmm, upon this idea of the moral law that we have. And that's one thing I was just speaking with Gary Habermas about, mm-hmm, that we find a lot in common with our Mormon or Islamic or Jewish neighbors, mm-hmm, in terms of morals and ethics. But this does not validate the idea that we can combine, pick and choose Buddhism with Christianity, or, you know, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. So that's an excellent point to make distinct. What do you make of, within pluralistic ideas, do you think that that these similarities, when we talk to our non-Christian neighbors, are a good place to start in terms of talking about our pluralistic society? Like Paul, I'm thinking of Paul, mm-hmm, in Acts 17, where he, you know, before he goes to the Areopagus and talks to the Stoics, he's walking around Athens and he's seeing the multiplicity of, mm-hmm, of gods, and he's grieved because, I mean, they're not gods, they're idols, mm-hmm, but he incorporates their understanding of divine reality,
right,
into his proclamation of the gospel, even using some of their own poetry. Mm-hmm. So it would seem, Lindsay, that it would be a good idea for a Christian to become, especially today in our information age, to become familiar with religious pluralism in the sense of knowing a little bit more about the worldviews by which we are surrounded, wouldn't you think?
Yeah, that's, you're speaking my language 100%. This is what I do. This is why I'm in apologetics. I think with Paul, what's really fascinating about Paul, who doesn't love Paul, but in Acts 17, it's not just that he's speaking with people who absolutely do not believe what he believes. He starts in the temple and he reasons from the scriptures in the Jewish temple. And then he goes out. And I think that's really important for us to remember, is that Paul was willing to speak with everybody and try to come to a place of agreement, and then not just shatter their worldview, but to ask good questions that allow thoughts to happen naturally. When we are talking with others who disagree with us or have a different worldview than us, it can be very easy to jump on the truth train and be aggressive in our presentation of truth. But in 1 Peter 3:15, we're encouraged to show gentleness and respect. And I think that Paul illustrates that well for us. He is well read and he is well versed in what the culture is doing. And he doesn't just admonish them for worshiping an unknown God. He acknowledges what they are doing and offers them an alternative with gentleness and respect. And if we can do that in our everyday conversations with whom you called neighbors, and these are very much our neighbors. If you can walk around your neighborhood and just begin to have real conversations with people, not starting with an ulterior motive of, I'm going to convert these Hindus to Christianity, but just showing them kindness and acknowledging them for for being who they are, which we recognize as image bearers of God, but recognizing them as, oh, you are actually literally my neighbor. I'd love to get to know you. And inviting them into our homes and recognizing that one Hindu isn't exactly like another Hindu and isn't exactly like another Hindu, and asking them, hey, I heard that Hindus believe in a lot of gods. How many gods do you believe in? Or how does that play out in your everyday worship? And asking them real genuine questions that that allow them to share what it is they believe. We shouldn't be afraid as Christians to, I think that there's this idea that we shouldn't immerse ourselves in other worldviews for fear that we're going to take on those worldviews. Well, my response to that question, that discouragement of learning is that you need to have a firm foundation in your own faith before you even start worrying about what other people believe. And we do that as apologists, right? We're hopefully immersing ourselves in the Word, and we're striving to learn more about what we believe and why we believe it to be true, and what support we have for the reliability of Scripture, for example, and what's contained in Scripture. And if we have that, and we're able to give a defense for the hope within us, which is ultimately who Jesus is. Jesus is our hope, right? And recognizing that, then if I want to read, if I meet with a missionary at my doorstep and the missionary says, hey, I'll read the New Testament if you read the Book of Mormon, I'm no longer afraid to read the Book of Mormon, because I know that the Book of Mormon doesn't have any hold over anything. It's not some magic voodoo book that is going to somehow take control of my life. That's not to say we should take the contents of the Book of Mormon lightly. It's to say we should prayerfully consider things and say, yeah, I'll read the Book of Mormon if you will absolutely read the New Testament. What an opportunity to have a conversation with missionaries at your doorstep and say, I have no problem reading this text. And then at the end saying, yeah, that didn't happen. What I understand Joseph Smith was trying to do with this, I never had the burning in my bosom. I personally, Lindsay, I've read the Book of Mormon, and I never had some sort of response to it, physical response to it. And I also know through my research that it's just not true. Shattering a missionary's worldview at your doorstep isn't really what Christ calls us to do.
I've had missionaries to the house, and listening to their stories, I mean, most of them are very young, 19, 20, 21. And you hear the stories of how they go to Christians' houses and they get doors slammed in their face. Right. And, you know, as you're saying this, you know, we could kind of use Paul here on Athens, I think, is a good sort of trope for our discussion here. There's a great book, Paul Capan and Kenneth Litwack. I don't know if you're familiar with it. It's called The Gospel in the Marketplace of Ideas. And they're suggesting that Paul actually was following some Greco-Roman rhetoric rules, things laid down by Aristotle, Cicero, and Quintilian, how you talk to people, basically. And one of the things that Copan and Litwack are suggesting is that Paul may have been following some Greco-Roman rhetoric technique by being complimentary in his opening speech by doing something to what they call overcome a hostile audience. Yes. Not that they were going to throw stones at him, but finding a way in which you can make your audience with a different point of view sympathetic to your point of view. And so you want people to recognize that you are taking their point of view seriously. Mm-hmm. And it's not just a superficial sort of, I've read a few lines from this, or I read a few lines from that, and now I'm going to hammer you with truth. I think it's, you know, the way in which Jesus ministered to people, God becoming a man and then patiently enduring growing up and adolescence and all of that, and then for a few short years embodied the Father to us, mm-hmm. you know, and spoke truth to us through disciples that didn't often understand what was going on, but there was a lot of patient cultivation, engagement. And I think the key there is, you know, with Paul or with your missionary friends or whoever we encounter, you know, in this day and age of pandemics and isolation and masks, mm-hmm. People are kind of starving for incarnate contact and dialogue with people. I think I see that more and more, that people are wanting to get in touch with one another, mm-hmm. In the old fashioned sense. But I think that's a key, Lindsay. First Peter 3:15. I'm certainly not perfected that verse yet. I have a little bit of an edge when you talk to your skeptic friends, and especially, as you know, we were talking before we started about how difficult it is in social media when you get pushback from atheists and skeptics that are very vocal about their opposition to what you're doing, even insinuating things. It can be very trying.
Right.
Let's not think that we're laying down a formula that's going to make all your non-Christian neighbors and friends love you.
Yeah, no. Yeah, even in the best of times, it cannot turn out the way you the way that you expect.
Right.
It.
Right. So you know, being congenial and using the be as harmless as a dove but wise as a serpent, mm-hmm. that I think it's even Greg Kokel in his tactics books toward the end, he's talking about, look, hey, I'm not guaranteeing that everybody with whom you use these tactics are going to love you instantly. There's going to be opposition. And that's what Jesus says, that people will hate you. Mm-hmm. And so in the concept of this, Lindsay, I think the greatest offense in our pluralistic society seems to be the exclusivity of who Jesus is and what the Christians, what Christianity proposes. I mean, this is the only way. No one comes to the Father except through Jesus. How can you, Lindsay Mendenwald? Did I pronounce your last name?
Yep, it's fine.
Mendenwald? Okay. So how can you, Lindsay Mendenwald, say that Jesus is the only way? I mean, what are you, I'm sure you get this as being in apologetics with Mama Bear, that what about your good Jewish neighbor or your good secular friend? Or look at all these good people by which you're surrounded, Lindsay. How can you say that only people that accept Christ are the ones that are going to go to heaven? What's a way to deal with this in our pluralistic society? First, do you think that's the biggest problem for us as believers, and when we talk to people of other faiths or no faiths? And then, you know, how do we deal with that?
Yeah, I think we get the you're causing me offense by your claims. I think we get accused of that pretty frequently. But it's not just non-Christians who are saying it. So in my profile, I mention some research that's been done by Barna. And in that, a good number of Christians actually said that everyone prays to the same deity. Okay, so that means that they're denying the exclusivity of Christianity in just that one statement, regardless of what the deity is called. So the problem with that is when you're looking at Hindus, for example, and I'm not meaning to pick on Hindus at all, they just keep coming up. They have many, many gods. I mean, we're talking about millions of gods. So is that statement that we're all praying to the same deity, no matter what that deity is called, saying that all of those millions of gods are all the same deity? Or the claim falls away as unbelievable when you start thinking about the multiplicity of gods that exist in theism, if we're just talking theism proper. The other thing that was determined is that in this Barna research was that a small percentage of Christians said that if your beliefs offend somebody, then those beliefs must be wrong. Somebody might be offended by a truth claim, but so let's just make it a silly example. I might be offended that somebody said that the sky is gray today and that there are many clouds. I might be personally offended by that, but that doesn't make that statement any less true.
Right. And there's an emotional component to that, because you might in the back of your mind think cloudy gray days reminds you of a time when you lost a loved one.
Yes.
Or something.
Yes.
And so there's an emotional investment in this offense. And I agree with you. And I've said the same thing. It's just because you might be offended does not necessarily determine whether or not the statement is true or false.
Right.
Personal offense doesn't actually deal with that. But it's a very real response.
It is.
To the proclamation of gospel truth.
Well, and I think that it's pervasive in our church, especially amongst those in the generation that is coming up, current high schoolers, young collegians, where they are frequently hit with the concept of my truth is my truth, and that's truth, and your truth is your truth, and that's truth, and everybody's truth is truth. Which again can't actually be true if those are competing truth claims. And so when Christians are thinking about this in the church, and we're thinking about how to respond to this accusation that we are exclusivists, we can acknowledge it. and I think sometimes that goes against the grain of what we think we're going to say. But to say, yes, absolutely, Christianity is exclusive, but so are most other religions, even those that claim not to be exclusive. So even Buddhists are exclusive in the sense that if you don't accept the teachings of Buddha, then you're just going to have to be stuck on the karmic wheel of reincarnation for the rest of eternity.
Right.
And Hindus are often called, you know, non-exclusivists. But again, if we're not following their path, we're stuck, and we're going to be, you know, stuck on this wheel for forever.
Well, and think about the exclusivity of what we might call our cancel culture today. That is, it's based on this relativistic idea that my truth is your truth. That is an exclusivistic claim, isn't it? That my truth is your truth is the truth about reality. That we can all have our truths, and we can all get along. And you mentioned in your profile the coexist bumper sticker.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I always ask, well, from where does that imperative come? Who is saying coexist? So there's always, I mean, there's no worldview that isn't exclusivistic. I mean, it even in your attempts to be all encompassing and relativistic, and you know, all truths lead to God, or all religions lead to God, or all beliefs lead to God. That is only one way, and a very mm-hmm. exclusive way. Because if you don't accept that, what happens in our culture today? You're canceled.
Mm-hmm.
You're outside. The very idea of cancel culture implies a standard from which you have erred.
Mm-hmm.
And so it seems that even in a pluralistic society, we can and should endeavor to point out that it's nothing unique to Christianity that we are exclusive about what we believe. And I think that's been helpful for me to point out this fact to people that,
mm-hmm.
look, this isn't just a religious issue at all. This is generally how humans believe.
My way is the best way. Otherwise, I wouldn't do it. And I think atheists have this, even if they deny having this, they're also exclusive. They're
right.
exclusive in their belief that religion is harmful, or religion is wrong, or whatever they're saying. That individual is being exclusive in what they are portraying as truth.
I asked Lindsay what her advice would be for those of us who are not experts or professionals and feel somewhat overwhelmed or intimidated by the idea of getting into the complexities of comparative religious studies.
I think we start in our own homes, right? And you don't really have to have any knowledge at all. It's starting with the word. I always tell moms, if you've got 5 minutes, like, you should start with the word. That's all you got. Go for it. I'm not going to judge you. Like, you got 5 minutes, go for it. But take a nap too, because naps are really important. I think it's funny because Mama Bear, we really started with a podcast because of this idea that moms don't have a lot of time to sit down and sit with a book, which is sort of true. But also we found over the last couple of years that moms are really desperate for information because they want to equip their kids. They want to equip themselves so they can equip their kids. And so actually on the blog, on the Mama Bear blog, the longest articles you'll find are my worldview articles. I kind of break the rules for blogs. I think that the ideal blog is like 1400 words and mine exceed that by thousands. And usually what I'll do for a worldview, so I'm going to think of a specific example. For Judaism, for example, I start with one article that is a crash course on what do Jewish people believe and what are some misconceptions folks have about Jewish people that aren't actually true. And then the second article is common questions kids ask about Jewish people. And those questions will range from maybe what your five-year-old will ask. So my daughter, for example, came home when she was in kindergarten because she had a friend who was celebrating Hanukkah and she wanted to understand Hanukkah more. And so I've got an answer for that on the blog. Or what is a dreidel and why do we sing? Basic answers to questions that kids have when they're confronted in everyday life. Maybe they'll get invited to a bar mitzvah. And so I answer, what is a bar mitzvah? So you can start in short snippets when it becomes relevant to your life. So if your kid comes home with a question about a specific worldview, you don't have to become an expert in that worldview right away. But if your kid then has a friend who is Muslim, for example, you might want to start learning about Islam. You can find resources about Islam specifically and study that worldview. You don't need to become an expert because what am I teaching you? I'm teaching you to ask good questions so that you can have good conversation with your kids, friends, family, and invite them over for dinner and get to know that better, but also get to know what is not true about the worldview. And how to answer some questions that your kids might have about that worldview.
If you've enjoyed today's episode, be sure to subscribe to the Apologetics Profile podcast. You can also support the podcast by becoming a patron at patreon.com/Watchman Fellowship today. For the profile, I'm Dave Mitchell. Thanks for listening.